2-minute meditation. Serenity prayer. God,
grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
All right. My name is Tarek. I am an addict.
What up, Tarek?
I want to thank all of you for coming back. I want to read something before I get started. It's written by Dr. Bob. As finally expressed and offered, the 12 steps are simple in language, plain in meaning, and they are workable by any person having a sincere desire to obtain and keep recovery. The results are the proof. Their simplicity and workability are such that no special interpretations and certainly no reservations have ever been necessary. And it becomes increasingly clear that the degree of harmonious living which we can achieve is in direct ratio to our earnest attempt to follow them literally under divine guidance to the best of our abilities. And so one of the things we want to focus on in this session, or the thing I want to focus on, is there are times since I gave myself to this way of life where I've had these experiences of what I call, what my sponsor calls, buy-in moments. Moments that sold me on the plan outlined in this book. I do want to start by finishing the story from the first session. Glad I just remembered that. My friend who was involved in the drug dealing business with me got me a lawyer. It's not lost on me the grace that's in this situation. The lawyer that he got me had been a police officer who had gone to law school, become a district attorney, and now he was a defense attorney. And so the cards were definitely dealt in my favor in that regard. And I got out of that treatment, that jail. They took me to that treatment center, and I went to that Friday night CA meeting. And I found a guy who was sponsored by that man I kept thinking about while I was in the county jail. It's interesting because this guy, Dante, people that know me are going to know this part of my story, but I love to tell it because this man means the world to me. He was my sponsor for the first 2 years, and he's still in my life to this day. I'm going to see him next weekend. And he used to be the guy on Friday night. You guys ever been to those meetings where the same person shares at the end of the meeting every single week? And that was this guy. And I called him. I don't think anybody else did it, but I did it. I called him the closer. That was like the how I made fun of him. I was like, oh, the closer. And we would go outside, and Dante would say things like this. Now, I'm not this hard edge today, but this is what I heard him say back then. If you're new, welcome, but you have nothing that we want. What we do want you to do is get a sponsor, work these steps, sign up for one of these big book studies, because this group had a bunch of big book studies at people's houses, and there were poster boards. You would sign up and go to that, find a ride to get to that person's house. They had them almost every night of the week. And we want you to get a big book study, work the steps, make amends, learn how to pray and meditate, start sponsoring people, and then we want you to come back and tell us all about that experience. And I would go outside with my friends in our little force field from the treatment center, and we would assassinate his character.
All the bosses.
Yeah, all the bosses. We'd be like, man, who does this guy think he is, man? Doesn't he know that this meeting is my spiritual filling station? And I'm supposed to get everything I can out of this meeting so I can just get enough relief so I just don't drink no matter what or just don't use no matter what, and I can get to a meeting tomorrow and do the same exact thing. And you know, I always took offense to the way those old timers in that meeting talked. And I would assassinate his character and say things that are not very, like the fact that somebody can refer to a big book enthusiast as a person that killed millions of people during World War II, like a big book, that blows me away. You know, because we fall in love and we have this extreme passion for what this book is talking about. And it's just a book full of stories. That's all it is. Within the stories, they give you some instructions. And so I end up with him as a grand sponsor, and I start going to his house on Monday nights, and I start documenting my recovery. Every time I passed a drug screen, I got a copy of it, sent it to my lawyer. I'd been kicked out of school in 2002. I had gone to grad school because I knew my parents would continue to give me money. They would fund my lifestyle if they thought I was in school. I failed out of school. I got kicked out of the graduate program, and my parents didn't find out till like a year and a half later because they got a letter in the mail. This whole time, they thought I was in school, and I wasn't. I even took financial aid out so I could buy a bunch of drugs and buy a car and get on the road and go see that band I like so much. And so at this point, I got back into school. The treatment center hired me as overnight staff. I got a second job parking cars at a restaurant as a valet. And I eventually got my own apartment right down the street, less than a mile down the street from the treatment center. So I had proof of employment. I documented all of it. And my court case kept getting continued. And I remember they offered me a deal, 3 years in prison in a work camp. I get 18 months. It was my first offense, but it was two Schedule I felonies in the state of Florida, drug trafficking. One was intent to distribute, one was drug trafficking. The reason I tell you the charges is not to say how badass I am. I need to tell you how bad the charges are because of what happened. And so our case kept getting continued, and you know, we went through a district attorney, two district attorneys, maybe three of them, a couple of judges, and then I'm in this little studio apartment. I think I had just gone over to the treatment center because I was still going there to help with the meditation meeting in the morning. I'd gotten back, maybe gone to the gym. I was in my studio apartment. I get a phone call from my attorney, and his name was Travis. And I get on the phone, and he had met with the district attorney, and these were his words. Tarek, I do not understand what just happened, but somebody upstairs truly loves you. They just dropped all the charges. I mean, that's why I told you what the charges were. In this day and age, how does that happen? I didn't get community service. I didn't have to snitch. The crazy thing is, when I made my first 8-step list, I had a lot of drug dealers that were my friends. I broke bread with them, but I owed them money. I was robbing Peter to pay Paul at the end. I had one guy who gave me 1,000 hits of ecstasy, and I just disappeared on him. Never paid him. He gave them to me on credit. You know, I got high with all of them, you know, made money, kept my lifestyle going. I would have to go make amends to those guys. I didn't make amends to the people down on the block that I ripped off. There was no way. I didn't know who they were. But there were a lot of people in that game, in that life, that I was, they were more than just people in the game. And I had to make it right with them. And to this day, there are some of them out there that think I worked for the police, that they wouldn't make amends to me. And what was I supposed to say when I showed up to them? If they asked me what happened to the charges, that God did for me what I couldn't do for myself? It don't fly in that world. And so I'm sitting in my studio apartment, and this one passage out of the foreword to the first edition, I believe, it says, "We hope after reading these pages, no further authentication is necessary." And I was bought in. I had experienced a miracle. A miracle is when we witness something that we cannot explain. And I could not explain to you how those charges disappeared. I remember calling Dante and this guy Randy, and I'd be terrified about going to prison. And their suggestion, first they'd ask me if I prayed about it. And then they'd say, Tarek, there might be somebody in there to carry the message to. And in some days, I bought that. Other days, I'd have to say the fear prayer. God, remove my fear, direct my attention to what you would have me do. And then I would try to help somebody. Man, I remember in the early days, I was sponsoring 6, 7, and 8 guys. I would have 3 sponsees stacked on the weekends, back to back to back, and I loved it. I will never do that today. But back then, it was the way I lived, because somehow there was this deep understanding that if I gave and gave and gave, I had the possibility of something good happening in my life, because I had taken and taken and taken for the first. I mean, I was 31 years old when I got clean, so I'm not going to say I was taken out of the fucking womb, but I started taking shortly thereafter, and that's what my life was about. And I remember Dante, man. Dante was he taught me the meeting before the meeting, and he taught me about the meeting, and he taught me the meeting after the meeting. And I try to impress this upon all the men that I work with, that we get to the meetings and at least 30 minutes before the meeting starts. And I remember asking Dante, he had become my sponsor when I got to step 8, and I wanted to spend some time with him. He said, meet me at the church. It was like, meet me there at like 5:30 or 6 o'clock. It was an 8 o'clock meeting. I'm like, why does this guy want me to meet him so early? And so I get to the church, and so he's got another guy he's sponsoring, and there's a guy named Adam who does a big book study upstairs. And he's like, look, I'm taking a new guy up. I'm going to help Adam with the big book study, but I want you to come into this is the auditorium, guys. This is the room we held this meeting in was probably 5 times the size of this room. And he walks me over to this closet, and he opens the door, and there's nothing but platforms with like 10 chairs on them. I'm talking like probably 20 platforms. And he's like, I need you to roll these out into the auditorium and just scatter them all over the auditorium. And there's going to be 2 guys here to help you in a little while. So around 6:45, 7, these other guys showed up, and we started setting the meeting up. And then the big book study ended, and he came downstairs, and he helped us finish setting up the meeting. And then I noticed he walked outside, and he stood by the entrance of the church. There was this long sidewalk with an awning on it, and he would stand there by the cigarette ashtray and smoke, and people were coming in. Everybody knew this guy's name, man. I wanted that. They respected him. They smiled. He smiled. He laughed. These are the things I wanted in somebody. And so we would have the meeting. And he greeted everybody before the meeting. And then we would have this meeting. And after the meeting was over, this man didn't go jump and start hanging out with his friends. He started breaking down all the chairs with us. And then he had a key to the church, which was really interesting to me. And he locked the church up. And I was on my way home. And he said, where are you going? I said, I'm going home. And he's like, no, we all go to Longhorn Steakhouse every Friday night. So we all went to Longhorn. I didn't get home till 11:30 or 12 o'clock that night. That became my Friday night for the next 3 years. Like 5, 6 hours, that was my home group. That was the type of AA and CA that I grew up in. And I do that to this day. You know, I don't get to go to dinner as much because there's kids involved now and stuff. But I try to do those things, because the bonding, you know, our 3 legacies, recovery, unity, and service, guys, the unity aspect of this, which is the fellowship, it doesn't happen in the meeting. Meetings are important. The storytelling happens in the meetings. The identification happens in the meetings. But the relationship building happens outside of the meeting. And so participating in our unity legacy requires more than attending meetings. Right? And that's something that I learned by the grace of God early on. And that man taught it to me. He taught me the meeting, and he taught me how to be a member. Like, I didn't feel like and this is going to be, some people won't agree with this, but I did not feel like I was a member of the 12-step fellowships until I had worked the steps. You know how they say you're a member as soon as you say you're a member? It didn't work for me that way. I always felt like I was on the outside looking in until I had worked the steps, and then I felt like I belonged. And so we would have our Lord's Prayer at that meeting, and I was at step 8. I'd started making amends. And we were in the Lord's Prayer, and at the end of the meeting, they always asked anyone looking for a sponsor, please raise your hand. And this guy had raised his hand, And Dante, who was my sponsor at the time, he was next to me in the Lord's Prayer. He said, as soon as this prayer is over, you're going to go over there and you're going to talk to that guy and you're going to make yourself available as a sponsor. And he like literally pushed me and nudged me that way. That's the AA I grew up in. That's the CA I grew up in. And those are important things, man. Someone had to show me. The big book says to show others precisely how we recovered is the main purpose of this book. We don't tell people what to do. The thing is, what are sponsors for? They're mentors. The big book doesn't even use the word sponsor. It uses the word protege. A protege has a mentor. And when you mentor somebody, you show them what to do. That's what we do here. We need somebody to show us what to do. And unfortunately, like Brandon says, there's a lot of mediocrity in these fellowships. I hate to be like the bearer of bad news, man, but I liked really good drugs. And, why am I going to settle for not the best people in the program? Why? Why do we settle when we come in here? It is a baffling thing that I've witnessed for 16 years. The first guy I ever tried to sponsor, this is one of my buy-in moments. You know, I'd been bouncing in and out of sober living, halfway house, IOPs. I started in 04. So this is now, I would say, late March, early April 2008. And I've got my first sponsee. His name is Tex. I can't even remember what his real name was. I just knew him as Tex. And Tex was in a sober living program. And Tex and I drove to his sober living program with my little big book. And I'm going to sit down and I'm going to start reading this big book with my first sponsee. And we're sitting in his kitchen table in his little sober living apartment. And I am looking at myself. I'm looking in the mirror. You know, I could see the stubbornness. I could see the compliance, but no surrender. I could see those are the very difficult guys to work with, the ones that have all the answers. There's nothing you can tell them that they don't know. I said, oh my God, I'm willing to do whatever I have to do to never be sitting where this guy is sitting. I don't know whatever happened to Tex. He didn't last for very long. But I know what happened to me sitting at that kitchen table. That was a transformational experience for me because I was like, oh my God, this is what I've been like this whole time. And I'm not like this anymore. And I bought into this way of life. In that studio apartment, when I got the news and I witnessed that miracle, I bought in. I was sold on the plan of action outlined in this book. And then I had that studio apartment for 9 months and the lease was running out. And I owed a lot of money, guys. I've been here now 16 years. 16 times 12 is 172, I think. Out of those 172 months, I have probably sent out a financial amends 125 to 192 months. My math's way off. 192 months, probably about 145, 150 of those months, I've made some type of financial amends payment. I've got one more financial amends to make. I'm still making it. I haven't made a payment in probably 5 or 6 months. But I've paid back probably close to $35,000 in my 16 years. And all that $35,000, I mean, I'd paid back. My first sponsor had me pull my credit report, and he said, everything in collections you need to, those are the things I want you. That's just the way he was. Do that. So I made all those. But now it's time to all the friends I owed money to, family members. I had to start making the restitution. And I had a decision to make. I'm 31 years old, and the options are I can keep doing this paycheck to paycheck. I was making decent money parking a car. Or I could move back into my parents' basement rent-free and start making some real amends. You know, well, man, do I really want to live in my parents' basement? And so I started praying about it, and I started seeking counsel, and everyone instructed me that I respected that you need to move into your parents' basement, you need to start making these financial amends. I lived in my parents' basement for the next 2.5 years, and it's one of the reasons I was able to pay back so much money, because I knew my life hung in the balance. And here's the kicker, everybody. I wasn't giving them my money. I was giving them back their money. But the mind will tell you this is my money, but it's not. It's their money. And so I started on that process, but there was something in those 10-step calls that I was making. The fact that I did something that Tarek, the old Tarek, would never have done that. And when you start in early recovery to start witnessing and noticing things about yourself, or you're taking actions that you're like, man, I would never have done this. You know? Yes, this is the psychic change we're talking about. And that, for me, looking back on it, that was one of the moments I knew something was different. Something was going on. I could see the importance with getting clear of my past. Like, so guys, when we get to the 10th step tomorrow, the 10th step is about being present and watching and remembering. And could you imagine trying to stay present in your life with nothing from the past to cling on to? Nothing can pull you out of it. You've made all your amends. It took me 8.5 years. But there's nobody on this planet, on any street, that I'm going to see and have to go to the other side of the street because I don't need them. I'm going to tell y'all a funny story. He didn't come here this weekend. I won't break my sponsee's anonymity. But this guy, I've been on his ass to make amends for a while. And about 8 or 9 months ago, he runs into somebody in public that he owes amends to, and he has to hide from them. Literally hid from this person. That's not freedom. There's nobody I'm consciously aware of that I'm going to run into where I'm going to shrink. Just not going to happen. Does that mean every single person that I tried to contact and I expressed my desire to make amends for right or wrong responded to me or had something nice to say when they responded? No. But I made every approach that I'm aware of in the 8th step. And it took 8.5 years to do all that, guys. I had over 200. And so for me, moving back into that basement and following the instructions of a sponsor, that for me was a buy-in moment where I knew something was different. The other thing is, you're 31 years old when you get clean, and you're parking cars at a really nice restaurant, you start to see some like 22-year-olds that drive some really nice cars. And you see these 22-year-olds with the very attractive women, and you start to think to yourself that I just wasted my life. I'm 31 years old parking a car, man. You know, I got to start making some money. Guys, this is one of the most, this is a bullet for people in early recovery, like straight up. The fact that we start to think that somehow making money and working out in the gym and having a relationship somehow translates to being in a recovered state or being in fit spiritual condition. It doesn't work like that, unfortunately. But our society and our culture convinces us those things equal success. So I was struggling working. So I remember calling this guy Randy. I would call Dante and I would explain to him, you know, I just feel like I've wasted my life. I need to get back into corporate America because I had been off and on in financial services. I'd lost every job I'd had because of my relationship with drugs and alcohol. And both Randy and Dante, but they'd say, no, you need to keep the recovery job. Keep the recovery job. Tarek, left to his own devices, does not keep the recovery job. He gets back into corporate America. I kept the recovery job for almost 3 years. It is one of the best things. That to me is an example of God doing for me what I could not do for myself. For some reason, I listened to them. And then once I completed my master's, I got an MBA. And then shortly thereafter, as a result really of some research I did in my graduate program, I got offered a job. There was a guy in the program that worked at this company, and he had something to do with me getting the interview, but I got the job. It's the company I work for today. All right. I worked there for 6 years, left in good standing, and then I went off and did a few other things, and then boom, I'm back here, and I've been back for almost 2 years. But the fact that I kept that recovery job for 3 years blows me away. That's a buy-in moment. I didn't know it was a buy-in moment there, but why would I have listened to them had I not bought in? I was bought into the way of life described in the big book. And so I want to share this story as well. And so in 2015, I've got I'm in my eighth year, I think, seventh year. Man, my math is way off today. I'm in my seventh year of sobriety, and I start to think I need to be making more money. And so I asked for a raise, and they declined to give me a raise. And I always had this, well, not always, since I met a man, you know, I got exposed to a man named Mark Houston. He had a treatment center in Texas. He was my hero. I got access to everything in his program through my sponsor at the time. I wanted to open my own 12-step immersion program. And so I put together a business plan and I shopped it around and I found a man that was going to give me $140,000 and he was going to be my silent partner. And we signed a letter of intent. This was about September of 2015. I had checked out of my job and the people I worked for could tell that something was off. So my VP calls me into his office and he's like, you know, I want you to take this weekend. I want you to write your dream job description with this company. And I also want you to write down how much money do you want to make? And I want to see if I can make that happen. And I was really resentful at this point because I'd asked for the raise back in like March or April and they said no. I was like, so now you're telling me you're willing to do something, but I've already signed this letter of intent with this guy to open this new business. And so then the prayers begin. Okay, I start praying. I have no clarity. All I have is uncertainty. I mean, I'm talking to people and I got no clarity. And so this one morning, at that point in my life, I was married. I had a stepdaughter. My stepdaughter was 7 years old at this point, six or seven. And I came out of my meditation room. I'd asked God for some guidance and direction regarding this decision. And I go downstairs and my former wife and my stepdaughter had left for the day. She'd taken her to school. But the Cali at that point was drawing everywhere. Every piece of paper had a drawing on it. So I come downstairs and on the coffee table, there's this one drawing. It's still in my office to this day, framed on the bookshelf. And it says, follow your dream, is what it says on the coffee table. And I had just asked for guidance and direction. So I called my Marcy. I was like, Marcy, well, ask Callie. Callie's in the backseat of the car. Ask Callie why she drew this today. And Callie's answer is like, I was supposed to draw that. And so I made my decision based on that drawing because I asked for guidance and direction and that's how it showed up. And so I end up resigning from that job and they offered me more money than I'd ever made in my life. $125,000 a year is what they offered me to stay. And I turned it down for something that was a risk, which was the business, but I felt like the prayer was answered. And so then I had this 12-step immersion program for 3 years and guys, the treatment industry is a machine and I was not ready for the machine. And I did a lot of things against the grain. I earned a reputation. And slowly, the census kept dropping. And after 3 years, it destroyed my marriage. It was a 24/7 job because I like to get my hands dirty. I don't want to just make, I wasn't in it for the money. And, people dying, getting close to families, riding an emotional roller coaster. I was like, I'm done. I need to get out of this. And so I just walked away from the business. And for a while, it was a failure. I was a failure. Yet again, Tarek tries something and it doesn't work out, right? So maybe there was a part of me that wanted to make some money. And so it stayed that way until 2 months ago. 2 months ago, I get invited to the closer. You remember the closer I talked about, Dante? I get invited to his daughter's wedding. You know, I've known his daughter since she was like 8 years old. First time I ever went to a big book study at his house, she rode up in the golf cart with her cousin and tried to charge us money to drive us from the barn to the main house. And so that's the first night I met that girl.
Good girl.
And she's always been important to me. And I helped with her early sobriety. She's been sober now for 6 or 7 years. And so the guy that she married was a guy that went through my program. And I mean, we were fortunate. We had a lot of guys. It was a 12-step immersion program. They were forced to have an experience with the steps. And this kid, Ben, stayed sober. And then two of his groomsmen were other guys that had gone through that program. And then I heard the night before at the rehearsal dinner that the groom's father had said something about my program being there at just the right time for his son to be there. So we always think our experiences are for us. but they're not. That program I was a part of was only supposed to be there for the time for those people to do what they had to do and have those experiences. And there I am sitting at this wedding realizing, holy crap, this is so much bigger than us. This is so much more involved here. These experiences I'm having are not for me, possibly. Are they for this entity called God? And that's what came to me. We are existing in the infinite self-disclosure of this entity. And that, to me, was the ultimate buy-in moment when I could see it in that way with that clarity, you know, and realizing, like, oh, my God, like, that's what this whole thing's about, right? We get afforded an opportunity to take the greatest liability we have ever had, which is our relationship with drugs and alcohol, and then we get to use it as an asset. And how does that work? Because I get to win the entire confidence of another addict or alcoholic in a few short hours. If I can convince them I've been where you are and I haven't been there in a really long time, and if you take my hand, I can show you. I can show you how you'll never have to be here again. And but you got to have those buy-in moments, everybody. And the buy-in moments, what they're about is being remembered. A part of my, remember in the first session I talked about my humanity getting ripped apart? And all those buy-in moments that I just described, I was put back together piece by piece by piece. So God remembers us, puts us back together. And you don't need to have a conception of God or a concept of God for any of that, for that power to work. It works on its own. But we do have to have willingness. We've got to have the willingness. That's all I got.
Thanks, Jason. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Brandon. We'll see where this goes. I'm sober. Well, correct that. I'm dry for about 2 weeks, doing odd jobs in the neighborhood, trying to, you know, enact my plan of making so much damn money, failing miserably. And I run into a buddy of mine that had stopped showing up at parties, and I asked him if he would, I asked him if he was still being good and not drinking. He said he wasn't. And I asked him if he'd take me to a meeting. And then proceeded to negotiate terms on when I was going to go to the meeting, because I thought I knew what I was supposed to be doing. And finally I negotiated the following Monday night, like a week away, which was his home group. And you remember that prayer I said when I was doing those nose bubbles of, you know, God, just please make it better. And I go to this meeting, this guy Bill sitting in the middle of the room, and he says, if you pray to God for direction, you better be willing to move your feet. And another little clue is given to me. I go to another meeting, and this guy's got handing out these CDs, and listen to the CD by this guy named Mark Houston. He starts talking about the 10th and the 11th step, and I mean, mind you, I hadn't even worked the first step at this point in time. And he's talking about this, like, mystical, like, new existence of steps 10 and 11. And another little kind of, like, thing that's getting me interested. It's kind of like, what's this all about? Like, what would it be like to wake up every day and realize in every moment that you've never been there before, and that existence is incredibly wonderful because you've never had the experience that you're in the middle of? And that blew my mind for a while, so I listened to it a couple hundred times to figure out what the code was. And then I got a sponsor, and he started fumbling me through the steps and started telling me some things, and I had started reading books and listening to speakers, and it didn't really seem like he really knew what was going on. And so he knew I liked listening to speakers, so he told me to go to this monastery out in Conyers, Georgia, and there were these two brothers from Texas that were going to be presenting And so I show up there, and he tells me to look for this guy named Tariq Khalil. He's got orange hair. He'll stand out. You'll see him. And I go to that thing, and I run into Tariq, and Tariq says, "What are you doing here? What do you think you're doing here?" And I said, "Well, I think I'm here to get a new sponsor because I don't feel like the guy that's taking me through the steps right now really knows what he's doing." And so Tariq said, "Well, I know pretty much everybody here. I can put you in touch with some people. Out of respect for Tony, I'm not going to sponsor you." And so I start interviewing sponsors. Tariq starts bringing me guys like Carl, and I look at Carl and I'm like, "Oh, I don't know, that's a scary beard, you know." So I hit it off with this guy named Neil. I understand why I hit it off with this guy named Neil, because he was a complete degenerate, and that's what I was. So, and so I start talking to Neil, and I tell Tariq that I think I'm going to ask this Neil guy, and Neil says he needs to talk to Tariq because Tariq sponsors him, and so he comes back and he says, "I'll tell you what I'm going to do is I'm going to have this guy named Nathan that I sponsor you." Now Nathan had, I was 90 days, so 90 days dry. He had 60 days, but he was five steps ahead of me. And so Neil's like, "You know, we'll still be in the same sponsorship family. So, you know, you can call me, we can hang out, we can do whatever." And so like it was weird because like this guy, Nathan, he's like 6'6", like probably 280. And there were only 52 people at this retreat. And like when Neil says, "I want to give you to this guy, Nathan," like the way my mind remembers shit is just funky, right? Like it was like there was pyrotechnic smoke, and then this 6'6" guy comes walking out of it, and all of a sudden he's standing next to me, and he's like, "Hey, I'm Nathan." And I'm like, "Where the fuck did you come from?" And so Nathan starts taking me through the steps. I want to pause that story and tell you about this experience that I had on, what was it, Wednesday night? So my buddy Scott, we've got a guy in our sponsorship family that right turned and relapsed. We later figured out what had happened is there was some dishonesty going on that had been perpetuating for a while, and he wasn't telling anybody about it. But so they're taking this guy Wayne to this place in very rural Georgia called the Bridges of Hope, and we got him a bed there because we got connections, and I was like, "Well, when Wayne gets there, he can say hey to Neil, because Neil, this guy that I asked to sponsor me 13 years ago, is back at the Bridges of Hope." Now, Neil's the same guy that jumped out of a moving car because he needed to go smoke crack, that thought that he kept choosing to smoke crack instead of spend time with his kids. And I think has been back to this place called the Bridges of Hope somewhere between 6 and 8 times in the last 13 years. Now, this is a 6-month program, and Neil's a good guy when he's in treatment, he stays. So, like, this guy spent between, like, 3 and 4 years of the last 13 years at this facility. And so my buddy Scott's driving him down there, and he's got another buddy, Edward, that's in the car, and we're having this conversation about Neil spending that much time there. And Scott is like, "I am never going to whine about having to sponsor people again. I am so glad I get to drive all the way over to Birmingham and go to this weekend and spend time, because I don't want to be like that guy. There's no way that you can tell me any way, shape, or form that I want to spend 4 out of the next 13 years confined in a treatment center." And so what does any length look like? Well, that day it looked like 7 hours in the car taking this guy to this place. So Nathan started sponsoring me, and I have an experience with the steps, and he decides at some point in time that he's not alcoholic anymore, and then he's just going to go smoke pot. And he disappears for 4 years. And then it was Taco Tuesday. And I was celebrating 4 years of sobriety, and and you remember the story about the fact that, like, I couldn't stay sober for more than 4 days, even with the death being there. So, like, 4 years, I'm serious. Like if I look at my drinking career in the last 10 years, there was never a period more than 4 days where I was stopped. Except for there was a procedure that I had to stop for 30 days, but I could go back drinking after that. But, like, other than that, 4 days was the maximum I could put together. So when I got to 4 years, this was kind of a mind-blowing experience. Like, how the hell do I stay sober for 4 years when I couldn't do it for 4 days? And so I start sending out texts to people, thanking them for, you know, having God bring them into my life. And I text Nathan. And I said, I'm so glad that God brought you into my life and I had the experience that I did, and that you communicated an experience with the steps the way you did, such that today I'm celebrating 4 years. And I know it was Taco Tuesday because he texted me back and he said, I'm coming back and I want you to sponsor me. And I mean, anybody walking in the kitchen in that moment would have wondered why this cooking this taco meat was so sad, because I was like, I was just bawling, like, how does that happen? Within a couple years after that, that guy Tony that started taking me through the steps that had triple digit or over 30 years of sobriety, he asked me to take him back through the steps. And he had a transformative experience, and that blew my mind. I recently finished taking a guy that's been sober for almost 40 years through the steps, and he's having an experience. And one of my mentors from way back has reached out to me because he's got some inventory that he wants to go through. And it's like, I don't understand how that guy that was so hopeless, that had nothing going for him, complete failure at living, complete failure at dying, is in a place where I've become useful enough where people start to actually respect me and ask me for guidance and want me to have an experience with them and walk them through experiences. Like, this is the stuff that, like, the repeated buy-in of the fact that, like, guys, the best I could have done is I wanted to die. Mm-hmm. And now, like, My kids like talking to me, and I have a relationship that is the greatest relationship on the planet, and I've got the trophy that says that I'm the most mediocre husband ever. And I've actually repaired that relationship with the woman that I was married to before that, to where there was a time period where I had the trophy for the greatest ex-husband too, but like... I've lost it since. But so, like, there's these repeated moments where I'm blown away at whatever this power is that's working in my life. I use my greatest manipulation skills to get my buddy Cinco to come over here and come to Birmingham and, like, give him guilt trips and explain to him, like, oh, well, you don't think God's going to provide for you if you take a weekend off and drive all the way over to Birmingham and find a way to get here. And I had an experience. A bunch of us that are in the same sponsorship family were here early, and as another guy walks through the door that we see in the squares on Sunday morning, and another guy and another guy, and Cinco comes over and he says, this is so incredible. Thank you for making me come. And it's these experiences that I continually get to have, where I get to see the light come on in somebody else's life. and I get to see this experience. You see, when I went out to that monastery when I was 90 days sober, is like, you notice how like there's, you go to certain meetings and there's like two or three or five people in the meeting that they're having a different experience with life. There's something else going on with what they're doing versus what everybody else is doing. There's like those people that they must be high or something because they seem like they're happy. And then there's everybody else that's just kind of hanging out, right? And I went to that monastery and I walked in the room and there was a room full of people that were having that experience of the lights being on. And I judged them the way that I do, and I started investigating, and these people had all worked the steps. And they were all having a transformative experience with this thing that we call God, or whatever they call it. And so, again and again, I get these little tiny experiences that if I'm paying attention, I see how this power is working. I was 4 years sober, and I was dead ass broke. I've been broke before, but not in sobriety. And it was a time period where I had taken a different job to try to go follow my dream and do something in remodeling and carpentry. And I took at least a 50% pay cut. And then a bunch of circumstances happened where the money I had saved up got burned through real quick. And there was this one morning where I was sitting in my meditation chair and I was totaling up all my bills that I had that I owed. I had $1,800 that was due today and I had $2,300 that was due by Wednesday. It was a Monday morning. It was 7 a.m. I very vividly remember this experience. And I'm looking at these bills and this guy owes me $1,600, but he's only willing to give me $800. Which doesn't, and I owe the painter $900 to get the painter on the job to finish the job so that I get the rest of the $1,600. And I'm in this situation where, like I have $40 worth of credit left on one credit card, and I have $13.74 in my bank account. And I'm looking at all this, and I'm just like, I don't know what to do. My wife comes out of the bathroom and she says, you always talk about things needing to be obvious for you to make a change. And she goes, isn't it obvious you need to be doing something else? And I said, yeah, but nothing else has shown up. And then I said one of those great prayers. It doesn't sound like a prayer, but this is what it was. I had it was a yellow notepad just like this with all those bills on it. I said, God damn it, I can't handle this. You handle it. It's a prayer. Doesn't sound like one. And so I went about my day. And I read the fear prayer of God, please remove my fear of and direct my attention to what you'd have me be. Please remove my fear of this financial insecurity. Direct my attention to what you'd have me be. And a thought would come. Call this person. Call that person. Do this. Go there. Do that. And way too long of a story for me to go into all the little tiny things that happened, but what ended up happening is by 9 a.m. on Wednesday morning, which Wednesday was the day that my child support was due to the mother of my children, that was that extra $500 that I needed to come up with. By Wednesday morning, I had paid all $2,300 worth of bills and I had $2,600 in my bank account. Now, there was a lot of stuff that happened in between there. There was a lot of action. There was a lot of movement that had to do. There was a lot of intuitive thoughts that had to happen. I wish I could tell you that was the last time I've been broke since I've been sober. It's not. But it was the last time that I didn't turn to whatever this power is and say, you got it, as it relates to money. Now, there's plenty of other areas where I still try to control things and dictate to God what my plan is and how it's supposed to work. But at least with money, like I've lost that desire to control it. And that's been a continuous buy-in for me. It seems like money always shows up just when I need it. And then it also turns out that, like, you know, learn some things. Learn about budgeting. Learn about these other things. I was in the middle of an experience about 6 months ago where I was getting to the point where I was really dissatisfied with the way that my body was and the way that I looked, and I knew that I knew that I needed some help. And so I prayed, God, you know, please help me with this stuff. Now, I don't like the way that the answer showed up, because what showed up was this intuitive thought. I know what an intuitive thoughts sound completely different than me, right? And so like this thought shows up of, well, if only you could get a sponsor for your health. And it's like, well, yeah, where am I going to find one of those? And then the next thought is, you have a sponsee that is a fitness coach. Yeah, I don't want to do that. Right? Because if I pick a sponsee as a fitness coach, then I'm going to have to do what he tells me to do, because I can't rail him for not doing the things that I ask him to do if I'm not doing what he's asking me to do. So I'm like, I'm not doing that. But what happened is I was texting them saying, hey, how much would you charge me to coach me in this stuff? And then he told me, and then I'm like, man, I'm not doing that. And then I find myself sending him the money to coach me. And then on a regular basis, I get these reports back of the things that I need to do and the things that I need to change. And I have to report back to him the things that I've done. You see, I can't, like, these little spiritual experiences, these little buy-in moments for me are continually happening, and they're against my will often. Is I'm a guy that, like I'm stubborn. And I don't want to change anything ever. In fact, like when my wife moves furniture or something in the house, I have to like go in the room and like stop hyperventilating, because like I'm a guy that likes my things lined up just right. You know, the peas can't touch the carrots and the things like that. Like it all has to be the way that it is. And you start moving stuff around on me and I got to readapt. So change, it's very difficult for me, and I almost have to get backed into a corner to where I have to move or I won't. And I wish that it wasn't that way. It's not as much that way as it used to be, but I just don't like change. And this force comes into my life, and then all of a sudden I'm further down the road, and I get the workout for week 26, and I realize, wait, if I'm getting a workout for week 26, that means that I've been doing this for half a year. But it doesn't seem like I've been doing it for half a year. And I get these buy-in moments where I start to realize, oh, that's been happening this whole time, and I just didn't even notice. There's people in this room that have been to treatment or tried to get sober multiple times. I'm certain of that. And my buddy Jay says it better than I've ever heard it. Is if God doesn't want me to be sober, why do I keep ending up back with these people again and again and again? Why do I keep coming back here? Why do I keep getting delivered back to you people? Where you tell me, work the steps, have a spiritual experience, and live a life beyond your wildest dreams. No, it can't be that. No, because you see, Brandon's still got a plan. And if everybody would just act right and do as Brandon wished, the chairs would be set up correctly. And people would go to the right restaurant. And my family would throw parties for me when I was leaving, and they would throw parties for me when I returned home. But they don't do that, because like they're busy. And they're busy thinking about them, and I realize that now, and it's like, oh, man, I'm a big deal, and you guys forgot to notice. Maybe I'll talk about that too. I'm a big deal with Marriott, and they they failed to acknowledge it for the first time this past week. Good news is I don't owe an amend for it. So the biggest thing with these buy-in moments, these experiences, is if I'm not paying attention to them, I'm going to miss them. If I'm not looking for them, I'm going to miss them. And if I'm drunk or high, I'm for certain going to miss them. I think that's all I got.
All right. We want to thank all of you for joining us this evening. We're going to do four sessions tomorrow. We'll have breakfast. We're going to have pizza for lunch. And thank the Over the Bridge group for putting this thing on. And we hope we see some of you or all of you tomorrow. 9 o'clock is the first session. We'll be here probably around 8 o'clock. Have a wonderful evening, everybody.